Welcome. You are listening to the Audio Information Network of Colorado. This recording is intended to be used solely by individuals with barriers to print.
Thank you for joining us for the New York Times Magazine. My name is Bill McCann. I'll read a featured story from the Times Magazine. No American has ever been number one in squash. Amanda Sobey can change that. The first American-born player to crack the world's top 10 is taking on Egypt's dominance of the game. It's a story by Michael Steinberger. Amanda Sobey took the court for her first match at the Windy City Open on a snowy Thursday evening in late February. The $500,000 tournament was one of the richest events in pro squash. It was being held at the University Club of Chicago, around the corner from Grant Park. A portable glass-walled court had been set up on the ninth floor in a room known as Cathedral Hall, a place that called to mind a medieval church. Despite the weather, 100 or so spectators had come out to watch. A few days later, the tennis legend Billie Jean King would attend the semifinals and finals. Sobey, the first American-born player to crack the world's top 10 in squash, arrived in Chicago ranked fourth. Her opponent on this night was a fellow left-hander, Canada's Holly Naughton. The 5'8" Sobey is an aggressive player. She pounds her forehands and backhands, volleys as often as she can, and seldom hesitates to go for winners. She also has an almost preternatural ability to anticipate where the other player is likely to hit the ball. Her game can be smothering, and she dispatched Naughton 11-5, 11-6, and 11-2 in a mere 29 minutes. Along the way, she showed flashes of the humor and pugnacity that have made her one of squash's more forceful personalities. "Were you watching?" she sarcastically asked the referee while disputing a call, a comment that elicited laughter in the bleachers. "I love performing. I love grinding it out. I love putting on a show," she told the crowd after the match. Sobey, a Long Island native, has carried the hopes of American squash for more than a decade. Ever since she won the World Junior Championship in 2010. By her own admission, it has been a heavy burden at times because of the peculiar history of squash in the United States. Starting around 1993, the year Sobey was born, Americans gave up their version of the game, called hardball, and adopted the version played by most of the rest of the world, which was referred to as softball. The differences were partly self-explanatory. One ball was harder than the other. But softball also used a wider court. From an infrastructure standpoint, converting to softball was a huge and costly endeavor, but a bigger challenge was becoming competitive at it. Sobey had one critical advantage over other American kids when she took up squash. Her father, Khaled, had played professionally in his native Egypt and had a deep understanding of softball. He coached all three of his children, and two of them became pros. Amanda's younger sister, Sabrina, is currently ranked 23rd. Khaled Sobey has been called the Richard Williams of squash, and the comparison is not unwarranted. Like Williams, Khaled was a headstrong figure determined to produce champions and at no small sacrifice for all involved. Amanda went undefeated over four seasons at Harvard, and a little more than a year after graduating in 2015, she was ranked sixth in the world. But her career has not been without setbacks. 2017, she tore an Achilles tendon, which sidelined her for months. More recently, she revealed that she had battled an eating disorder for much of the previous decade, which was at least partly connected to the pressure she felt as the standard bearer for American squash. She says she's recovered, And in April last year, she entered the top five. Sobey, along with her sister, is part of a quartet of highly ranked American women. Olivia Feature is 11th. Olivia Klein is 17th. On the women's side, at least, the United States has finally become a power in squash. The American men are progressing. Albeit not as quickly. The highest ranking American man, Todd Harity, is number 36. If the 28-year-old Sobey can get to number one, it will be an epical achievement for American squash. But the personal dimension is even stronger. I want to do it for myself because I know how much I've overcome. To reach the top, however, she'll have to find a way to pass the three Egyptian women ranked ahead of her. Egyptians have dominated men's and women's squash in recent years with a freewheeling style, lots of clever shots, abundant use of angles, and deception. That's done much to change how the game is played, while also making it more entertaining. Sobey has the same quick-strike attitude as the Egyptians. The question is whether she can execute it well enough on a sustained basis to eclipse them. She had an opportunity to take a step in that direction at the J.P. Morgan Tournament of Champions in New York City early in May. Now an even bigger one awaits. The World Championships get underway on May 13th in Cairo. On the back of Egypt's success, the city has become squash's de facto capital and hosts several prestigious tournaments. But Sobey has yet to win one of these and has made a final only once. She finds it hard to produce her best squash in Cairo, a problem that seems rooted to some extent in her complicated relationship with her father. "I am Khalid Sobey's daughter there," she says. "I'm kind of a little branch entity of him, which I don't really like." Playing in Cairo also highlights her complex identity as an athlete. She's an American superstar, but she's also the daughter of an Egyptian, trying to break the Egyptian grip over her sport. She concedes that it can be disorienting. "I don't know who I am when I'm here," she says. In his 1926 book, The Game of Squash Rackets, Charles Arnold, a prominent coach and player at the time, observed with typical British understatement that the ball is a very vexed question in squash. Although the sport was invented in England nearly a century earlier, the British had not yet settled on a standard ball. Players in the United States, meanwhile, were using a different ball entirely. It was firmer and livelier than the ones the British were using. The upshot was that Americans ended up playing a game called hardball on a court that was 18 and a half feet wide, while the British and others played what came to be known as softball using a 21-foot-wide court. Hardball and softball coexisted for decades. American players made occasional forays onto the softball tour, losing quite badly most of the time. By contrast, softballers seemed to have little difficulty picking up hardball. In the mid-1980s, Pakistan's Jahangir Khan, the number one ranked men's softball player, entered 15 hardball tournaments and won 13 of them. By the early 1900s, there was a growing consensus in the United States that softball wasn't just more physically demanding, but also required more skill. This, coupled with the hope, still unrealized, that squash would become an Olympic sport, led to hardball's demise. In the years following the transition to softball, a couple of American players fared well. Latasha Khan got to number 18 in the world in 2000, and Julian Illingworth to number 24 in 2012. Most of those struggled to master the intricacies of softball, but laid the groundwork for the coming of age that American squash is currently in the midst of was an influx of foreign players and coaches. In the mid-1990s, Trinity College in Connecticut began recruiting from places like England and India. Palisanti, Trinity's coach then and now, says that there was a resentment among people who believed that roster spots should be reserved for Americans. "We got beat up," he recalls. But the imports paid off. From 1999 to 2012, the Trinity's men's squash team won 13 consecutive intercollegiate championships and 252 straight matches, the longest undefeated streak in college sports history. To keep up with Trinity, other schools started bringing in players from overseas. Asante, who also served as the United States national coach for many years, says that what was good for Trinity was ultimately good for American squash. "The foreign recruits forced Americans to improve their play. We blew up the country club," Asante says with a laugh. Even so, squash was still seen as a useful sport for athletes with Ivy League aspirations, and well-to-do American parents were willing to spend whatever it took to turn their children into prospects. This created a lucrative market for foreign coaches, among them quite a few who had been top players. Pro squash is not especially remunerative. The winner's purse at the Windy City Open was $35,720, which is considered a good payday, and retired stars often found that they were able to earn more money teaching squash to wealthy Americans than they had made as players. Several former number ones coached in the U.S. So does Rodney Martin, an Australian player who reached number two in the early 1990s and is based in Connecticut. Martin says the United States faced a sharp learning curve when it came to softball, in part because there wasn't the expertise in coaching. These days, some of the best minds in the game are working with young Americans. They are being trained to take on the world, and one country in particular, Egypt. When the United States switched to softball, the dominant powers were England, Australia, and Pakistan. Now Egypt rules. Since 2006, six different Egyptian men have held the number one ranking. In the last 6 years, an Egyptian woman has been number one for all but 4 months. At the moment, seven of the top 10 men are from Egypt. Egyptian women hold 5 spots in the top 10. The rise of Egyptian squash is, in its own way, a story as unlikely as the United States ditching its version of the game in order to fall in line with everyone else. Squash has a long history in Egypt, dating back to the British occupation, and the country turned out some excellent players over the years, Khaled Sobhi among them. But there is little to suggest that Egypt would become the juggernaut it is today. Its ascendance began when a player named Ahmed Barada reached the final of a major tournament in Cairo in 1996 and then rose to number two in the world. A charismatic figure, Barada touched off a squash boom. It helped that President Hosni Mubarak was a player himself and eager to promote squash. Amir Shabana's victory at the 2003 Men's World Championship increased the game's cachet. In a nation that had few international sports stars, the finest squash players became celebrities, which encouraged more participation. Karim Darwish, an Egypt who got to number one in 2009, says that he, Barada, and Shabana became idols who were looked up to, and that their success brought waves of players into the game. Darwish now runs a squash academy in Cairo with about 2,500 children enrolled between the ages of 4 and 12. Another factor for Egyptians, too, squash has proved to be a way into leading American universities. Ali Farag, who held the number one ranking most of the last 2 years, he's now number two, attended Harvard. Yosef Ibrahim, a Princeton senior, is ranked 11th in the world. A barrel-chested lefty who calls to mind Rafael Nadal Ibrahim reached the men's final of the Windy City Open and came within 2 points of winning, thanks in part to Egyptian students. High-level collegiate squash is almost an extension of the pro circuit. Amanda Sobey also helped make it that way. She had been ranked as high as 17th before she arrived at Harvard in 2011 and climbed to 10th by the time she left. She had played some pro events as a junior and continued to do so while in college. In contrast to most of her classmates, her career path was established before she even set foot on campus. She was raised for squash greatness, and turning pro would be the inevitable next step after Harvard. The Arlen Specter U.S. Squash Center, which opened last year, occupies a converted armory on the campus of Drexel University in Philadelphia, named for the late United States Senator from Pennsylvania, who was a squash enthusiast. The $40 million facility has 20 courts. On a Wednesday afternoon in March, Sobey was there playing a practice match against Olivia Feacher, who, in addition to being Sobey's closest American rival, is her best friend on the pro tour. A game within the game was going on when I arrived to watch. A loafer had been placed alongside each of the walls, just behind the service box. And while Sobey and Feacher were playing, they were also trying to drive their shots so tight to the wall and with an up depth that the ball would hit a shoe. As usual with Sobey and Feacher, they were stakes. Every shot that struck a shoe was worth a buck, and whoever was trailing at the end had to pay in cash or spring for coffee or a snack. Sobey, who moved to Philadelphia from Boston in 2020, ended up winning both the regular game and the shoe game. It was a small measure of revenge. Feacher, a 26-year-old Princeton graduate, had unexpectedly beaten her in their last two tournament meetings, most recently in February in Cincinnati. Sobey told me she was salty after that match, but agreed to stick around to coach Feacher for the rest of the weekend. The women usually room together on the road. Following their practice, they talked about their upcoming trip to Egypt. Both were leaving in a few days for the tournament in Cairo. While Sobey enjoys seeing her Egyptian relatives, the city's traffic and heat grate on her, and she finds it hard to be a woman there. "I'm a very outspoken female, and I don't like to be diminished in Egyptian culture," she says. But she acknowledges that her feelings about Egypt are colored by what was, for many years, a sometimes difficult father-daughter dynamic. Sobey grew up in Sea Cliff, New York, on the north shore of Long Island. In addition to her sister, who is 3 years younger and the more naturally gifted player, at least according to Sobey, she has an older brother, Omar, who played squash in college and works in real estate in Philadelphia. Her mother, Jody Larson, is a school music teacher. Her parents divorced when Sobey was in second grade. Her father, who came to the United States in the mid-1980s to teach squash, worked for several years as an accountant before taking a job as the pro at a local country club, which gave him more time to coach his own children. When it came to squash, Khaled Sobey had a lot of ambition for his children, and Amanda says he was very demanding. If his expectations weren't met, Khaled made his unhappiness clear. His deliverance was harsh, as she puts it. They clashed a lot. I would cry on court because I'd be so upset, but she stayed with it because she wanted to excel. I loved the sport enough that he didn't push me over the edge, she told me. She says she knows that her father's strict approach was coming from a place of love, and that if he didn't push us as hard and wasn't as involved, we wouldn't be as successful. When I spoke to Khaled Sobey, who now splits his time between Egypt and the United States, he agreed that it wasn't easy to separate his role as coach and father. Referring to Amanda, he said, "She would always say to me that once we were off the court, I had to stop being her coach and just be dad." He added, "I learned it the hard way." The Sobey children didn't train exclusively with their father. Like Richard Williams, Khaled Sobey sometimes sought input from other coaches. Rodney Martin worked occasionally with the Sobey sisters. He says Amanda was phenomenal at a young age, not only because of her skill, but also because of her dedication. It was clear to Martin that she had the talent and the will to get to the top. She was going to make a good fist of it, he says. Amanda captured numerous junior titles. She also won 4 pro tournaments when she was just 16. Some people told her that her game would stagnate if she went to college instead of turning pro. But she was eager to show that she could continue to improve while pursuing her education. "I'm very stubborn," she says, "and I like proving people wrong." The expectations were enormous when Sobey got to Harvard. "There was a target on my back," she says. But she not only went 62-0 in college, she dropped just 2 games. A squash match is best of 5 games. Outside squash, Sobey found Harvard challenging. She knew she was admitted mainly because she was an accomplished athlete. "I got in for my squash," she says flatly. She majored in social anthropology with a minor in global health, but always felt inferior to her peers and dreaded being called on in class. Her bulimia started in college. The problem persisted after she turned pro. She was often lonely while traveling, and losses left her crestfallen, which led to more binging and more purging. "I internalized a lot of pressure," she says, "and I coped with food." Despite their close friendship, Feature was shocked to learn that Sobey had been struggling with an eating disorder. "I had no idea," Feature says. "Part of it was that Sobey was so seemingly in control. First time we roomed together, I noticed how professional she was, with how she dealt with sponsorships and how she had her nutritional supplements here and her stacks there and all her match outfits laid out," Feature recalls. "You just see how regimented and disciplined she was, and to me, that was hugely inspiring." Sobey eventually told her sister about her bulimia, and the moment turned out to be a mutual confession. Sabrina Sobey had also struggled with an eating disorder. "I had a similar experience," Sabrina says, "and we kind of shared both of our stories with each other." A sports psychologist was able to help Amanda address the problem. Looking back, she's astonished that she was able to play at such a high level all those years. "I think I almost don't give myself credit for how strong I was mentally." U.S. Squash, the national governing body, subsidizes around a dozen American players, each of whom receives $7,500 to $40,000 annually. The aim is to make squash a more viable career option for them. Between that support, her tournament winnings, and her exhibition fees, Sobey makes a reasonably good living by squash standards. She recently purchased a house in Philadelphia, and she no longer needs a second job. In Boston, she worked as the assistant coach of the MIT men's team. "This is the first time where I can be a full-time professional," she told me. With newfound financial stability, Sobey's free to concentrate on toppling the Egyptians. In a sense, though, she has been chasing them most of her life. On annual summer visits to Cairo, Sobey and her siblings would spend their days sparring with local kids at the Heliopolis Sporting Club, among Egypt's most famous squash venues. Sobey says that for her father, the Egyptians were always the benchmark for progress. "He expressed impatience if they did well, and I wasn't up to par with them." Egyptians are renowned for their explosive play. Instead of the attritional British style, in which matches are won by running the opponent to exhaustion, the Egyptians took to endpoints quickly and with as much panache as circumstances allow. They were helped by an adjustment to the lower boundary on the front wall. It was reduced by 2 inches in 1990 for the men and in 2015 for the women. That spurred more risk-taking. The game still features plenty of lung-burning rallies, but there's much more action now in the front of the court, more drop shots and guileful flicks. John Nimick, a hardball pro in the 1980s, marvels at how the Egyptians have changed squash. They have made it so kinetic, so angular, so fast, so creative, he says. Given Selby's heritage and all that time that she spent in Cairo as a child, it's not surprising that she plays a similar style to the Egyptians. And as a pro, she has notched victories over all three women who are above her in the rankings. Nuran Goar, Noor El Sherbini, and Hania El Hamani. But they are very difficult opponents. I've played them, and maybe the entire match they've given me one error, Sobey says. Consistency and judicious shot selection are paramount, and that's where Sobey sometimes runs into trouble. During her second match in Chicago against the Welsh player Tesney Evans, ranked 14th, Sobey won the first two games easily and held match points in the third, but she squandered them and ended up losing the third and fourth games before prevailing. She was beaten the next round by world number 5, Joelle King of New Zealand. Sobey is coached by Wael El Hindi, a former top 10 player from Egypt who owns a racquet club in Boynton Beach, Florida. She hired him in part because he knows the mind of Egyptians. El Hindi told me that he was working with Sobey on developing a better sense of when to attack and when to pull back. The key for Sobey, he says, is to be able to impose her game on opponents without taking excessive risks. What impresses him about Sobey is her willingness to experiment. She's such a great student, El Hindi says. Even at her level, she's open to learning things, to changing things. At the British Open in April, Sobey showed signs of progress. In the quarterfinals, she defeated Feature 3-0 in 35 minutes. She was in total command from start to finish. No lapses, relentlessly aggressive, without being reckless. The next day, she faced Goar, world number 1. Sobey had a winning record against the Egyptian, but had lost their 4 most recent meetings. The victory over Feature left her feeling very confident, though. She might have drawn encouragement, too, from the fact that Paul Call, a New Zealander, had just supplanted Ali Farag as the men's top-ranked player, a crack in the Egyptian wall. "I thought I was ready," she said. Unfortunately for her, Goar was in ruthless form. As hard as Sobey hits the ball, Goar seemed to generate even more power, and the American quickly felt overwhelmed by her pace. "Instead of relaxing, I got very panicked, anxious," she says. Goar pounced on every loose shot, appeared to hit winners almost at will, and took the match 3-0. Sobey admitted to being caught off guard by how well her opponent played. "Been a while since I had such a poor loss on a grand stage," she says. But if the match showed that the gap between her and the best Egyptians is wider than she might wish, it also demonstrated the distance that Sobey has traveled in other ways. She was crushed after the defeat and felt that old sense of shame and inadequacy. "My eating disorder voice," as she puts it. She knew that spending the night alone in her hotel room was not a good idea. Instead, she went to visit some friends. By the following morning, Sobey says she was already strategizing about what she would do differently against Goar the next time. In its own way, that felt like a victory. And now a story about a recent Jeopardy champion, Mateo Roach. Mateo Roach ended her Jeopardy streak. Her Blazers live on. The 23-year-old won 23 games in a row. Her personal style has helped make her a star. Taya Roach, the 23-year-old Jeopardy champion, blew past competitor after competitor. Some of the games were nail-biters. In one, she defeated her opponent by just a dollar. But the LSAT tutor, a 2020 graduate of the University of Toronto, ended her streak on Friday, winning 21 straight games and earning $560,983, plus a $2,000 consolation prize for her loss. She is among the show's winningest regular season players, just behind the likes of Ken Jennings, James Holzhauer, Matt Amodio, and Amy Schneider. Like Mr. Jennings, Ms. Schneider, and Arthur Chu before her, Ms. Roach achieved crossover fame during her tenure on the show. She drew attention from Jeopardy fans in part for her distinctive playing style. She tended to wager small on Double Jeopardy and Final Jeopardy, for instance. But her manner is attention-grabbing, too. Ms. Roach gesticulates, and not just with her hands. Her wrists also get on the action and have become the subject of social media attention. All Jeopardy contestants answer in the form of questions, of course, but Ms. Roach landed her response with an extra layer of upspeak. As she puzzled through her answer, she talked out loud to herself. Or was it directed to the host or to the audience at home? Her play could be disarmingly casual. On the final Jeopardy clue that ended her streak, she appended a lowercase IDK, text slang for I don't know, to her scribbled incorrect answer. Ms. Roach was the most high-profile Gen Zer to appear on the show, and her fashion sense reflected her generation. She appeared in what might be called Merkelcore, as in the former Chancellor of Germany. Her signature look was bold, boxy blazers. Ms. Roach says her fame was a surprise. I don't know that there's kind of a way to psychologically prepare for this sort of thing, she said in an interview on Friday when her streak ended. But still, she gave some thought to what she wore. Are you there? And now an interview begins. Are you getting a lot of recognition in the streets? I had not been home the entire time that the games were airing, so I hadn't watched any of them with my parents in Nova Scotia. We drove up to Cape Breton to see my grandparents yesterday and came back down to Halifax today. My mom and I stopped at this restaurant on the side of the road. I was wearing a KN95 mask, and one of the women working the restaurant was like, I recognize you by your earrings. I swear it was like 10 women came out from the kitchen, like clowns coming out of a clown car. They just kept coming out to say hello. How would you describe your personal style? How could I describe it that can be printed in the Times? I'll just say it this way. I dress like a lesbian. I saw a lot of tweets after my first appearance where I hadn't really like spoken publicly about my orientation or identity from people who were queer that were like, we could tell. I definitely dress more masculine. I wear either entirely neutral tones, or if I'm going to wear something bright, it's going to be really gaudy and really loud. Even when I'm going to an event, I want to be comfy. If you see me during the summer, I'm one of those people that's raiding Old Navy for all of the terrible print shirts that I can find, or going to thrift stores looking for all the big Hawaiian dad shirts. When you were thinking about your appearance on the show, what went through your mind? I started rabbit-holing a little bit before the show. I realized that there's a Twitter account that talks about what people wear on the show. I was like, okay, I want to make sure that I'm wearing something that I feel like I look good in. I was much more concerned about feeling comfortable with what I was wearing. I bought precisely one new item, a tweed blazer. Everything else was stuff I already owned, with the exception of one time. I wore this black cardigan that came from Wardrobe because I think that they were like, we need to put on another layer just so that there's like something else going on. And I was obviously not thrilled to have to wear the cardigan from Wardrobe, but it was fine. I wore the same pair of pants almost every single game because you don't see them. This pair of black stretchy palazzo pants from Zara. The only time that I wear a different pair of pants was two episodes where I was wearing a jumpsuit. Do you do a lot of secondhand shopping? Most of the blazers I wore on the show were from vintage or secondhand stores in Toronto, with the exception of a crushed velvet one, which was given to me by a friend who was cleaning her closet. It's easier to find high-quality pieces at a reasonable price point that way. I like the notion that it's more sustainable. I'm not a big value, village, or goodwill type shopper just because I don't enjoy shopping that much. I find the process of having to sift through a lot of garments to be just not enjoyable. So the places that I go to tend to be places that have already curated a selection. Are you a Depop girl? No, I'm not. I've tried to look around on there. They don't have a great variety of sizes. Oftentimes I find that it's a lot of people that will maybe buy oversized things and then they'll make a two-piece out of what was previously one shirt and I'm like, well, I can't wear that. Obviously, your financial situation has changed as a result of being on the show. Do you think that your style will change at all along with that? I don't know that my style will change. I do think that I will probably feel a bit more free to buy pieces that are more expensive. I don't even take Ubers, though I can absolutely afford to because I just hate spending money. So I don't think I'm going to suddenly go out and completely revamp my wardrobe. I probably will use the opportunity to buy at least one suit and have it tailored because that's something that I think is, especially as a woman, quite difficult to do and can be kind of expensive. I've never been able to find the two-piece matching suit where both parts fit me. Are you keeping the blazers, or have you burned them already? No, I love my blazers. Why would I get rid of them? I saw you tweeted, "My identity isn't relevant to how well I performed on the show, but it is relevant in that I am someone who is read as queer in real life because of the way I dress, talk with my body, and other intangible factors." How did you see that play out? I want to make sure that if I'm only going to do this one time, I'm doing it in a way that I feel proud of. I wasn't trying to really moderate in a major way how I was talking. I knew that I didn't want to dress more feminine than I might otherwise, just to look more presentable to some hypothetical person in middle America that might not like how I dress. I'm glad I showed up as my authentic self because it would have been a lot of stream for me to keep up a certain image that was not true to who I am over that many games. I wasn't thinking about it in terms of, oh, it's going to be so important for people to see a young queer person on the show. To the extent that I thought that mattered, it mostly mattered to me. That was from the style section of the Times, and so that's why I was so focused on the way she dressed. And now another featured article. How many friends do you really need? Social circles were shrinking even before the pandemic. Here's what the science says about the number of close friendships we should have. This is a story by Catherine Pearson. An ongoing argument my husband and I have, which has become more contentious during the pandemic, is about how many friends we should have. We both have one or two close friends and siblings we like to spend time with. Plus, we're busy parenting two young boys who sap most of our energy. As a textbook introvert, this feels like plenty of friends to me. Excessive, even. But my husband is an extrovert who comes alive around other people. As we slowly emerge from the pandemic, I can feel him yearning for more. He's not alone. For years, friendship in America has been in decline, a trend that accelerated during the pandemic. 3 decades ago, 3% of Americans told Gallup pollsters they had no close friends. In 2021, an online poll put it at 12%. About a year into the pandemic, 13% of women and 8% of men aged 30 to 49 said they'd lost touch with most of their friends. There are health implications to all of this. Friendship can be an important factor in well-being, while loneliness and social isolation, distinct but related conditions, can be associated with an increased risk for conditions like depression and anxiety, or heart disease and stroke. An oft-cited 2010 meta-analysis led by Julianne Holt-Lunstad, a professor of psychology and neuroscience at Brigham Young University in Utah, concluded that loneliness is as harmful to physical health as smoking 15 cigarettes a day. It's a natural question, Dr. Holt-Lunstad said, about the ideal number of friends. Just like we have guidelines and recommendations for the amount of sleep we get and how physically active we are, this is health relevant. While she and other friendship researchers admit there aren't many studies that have specifically tackled the question of how many friends people should aim for, those that have been done offer a range, and somewhere between 3 and 6 close friends may be the sweet spot. What does the research say? If your goal is to simply mitigate the harmful impact loneliness can have on your health, what matters most is having at least one important person in your life, whether that's a partner, a parent, a friend, or someone else, says Jeffrey Hall, a professor of communication studies at the University of Kansas. Going from 0 to 1 is where we get the most bang for your buck, so to speak, Dr. Hall said. But if you want to have the most meaningful life, one where you feel bonded and connected to others, more friends are better. The best known theory of how many friends can be, though not necessarily should, comes from British psychologist and anthropologist Robin Dunbar. What has come to be known as Dunbar's number contends that humans are only cognitively able to maintain about 150 connections at once. Subsequent research has put the number higher. That includes an inner circle of about 5 close friends, followed by larger concentric circles of more casual types of friends. Other estimates are in a similar ballpark. One 2016 study suggested people who have 6 or more friends have improved health throughout their lives, while a 2020 study by Suzanne Deggs White, professor of chair and chair of the Counseling and Higher Education Department at Northern Illinois University, found that middle-aged women who had 3 or more friends tended to have higher levels of overall life satisfaction. Those estimates seem to track with people's sense of how many friends they should be shooting for. Dr. Deggis White recently conducted a survey of 297 adults, which has not been published or subject to peer review, but found that 55% of participants believed 2 to 3 close friends was ideal, while 31% thought 4 to 6 was the goal. But all this can be really challenging to study because friendship and intimacy are subjective. And there isn't a widely used scale researchers share to define those concepts across studies. Closeness can be particularly squishy. Dr. Deggis White said that to a certain extent, it's a case of in your heart, you know the difference. It's also unclear how social media factors into all of this, as research suggests the size of a person's online network may not have any meaningful impact on their perceived well-being. While many friendships have faded during the pandemic, many people have found connections online. How can you tell if you need more friends? While friendship research offers some benchmarks, it may be more useful for most of us to simply do a bit of soul searching. Marissa Franco, a psychologist and author of the forthcoming book, Platonic, How the Science of Attachment Can Help You Make and Keep Friends, recommends starting with a fairly obvious but powerful question: do I feel lonely? Loneliness is a sort of signal or alarm system, Dr. Frankl said. Everyone feels lonely from time to time, but this is a deeper question about whether you regularly feel left out or isolated. One recent survey suggests that roughly 1 in 3 Americans have experienced serious loneliness during the pandemic. It also helps to ask yourself if there are parts of your identity that feel restricted, Dr. Frankl said. Different people bring out different parts of us. So when you have a larger friend group, you're able to experience this side of yourself that loves golf, and this side of yourself that loves cars, and this side of yourself that loves flowers, she said. If you feel like your identity has sort of shrunk and you're not feeling quite like yourself, that might indicate you need different types of friends, she added. Of course, making friends in adulthood isn't always easy. Research shows people struggle with it because they find it difficult to trust new people and because they are simply crunched for time. For those reasons, it's often easier to start by rekindling old friendships that have fizzled. Take initiative and don't assume that friendships just happen organically, she said, Dr. Frankl. But be judicious, spending time with friends you feel ambivalent about because they're unreliable, critical, competitive, or any of the other many reasons people get under our skin, can be bad for your health. The amount of time you actually spend with your friends matters. 2, Dr. Hall's research suggests that on average, very close friendships tend to take around 200 hours to develop. Quantity and quality go hand in hand. To a tired introvert like me, the effort that requires just sounds exhausting. Luckily, Dr. Hall added that finding 3 to 6 friends isn't a magic number for everyone. Your personality and the characteristics of your life are going to make a difference, he said. So maybe my husband is right. When I am no longer consumed by pandemic fatigue and child rearing, I might kick myself for not having done more to build a solid group of friends. But I've got time to bring up my numbers. And I'll read from the letter of recommendation section. I'm a fashion editor, and I shop at the dump. I used to be ashamed of my secret, but I'm ready to come clean. It's a story by Veronique Highland. The plain black wicker bag between my knees bore no designer label. Just a made-in-British-Hong-Kong tag that dated it to the last millennium. Extravagantly sturdy, it had the air of what magazines might call an investment piece. When the friend sitting next to me at a New York Fashion Week event inquired about its provenance, I decided for once not to lie. "From the dump," I said. When I was a fledgling fashion editor living broke in New York, the dump was my secret. Or at least it was a secret in New York. On the summer trips I made to small town Massachusetts, the dump there was an agora of junk, a festive of refuse. The local newspaper listed what was new and hot, and people gathered just to gossip and shoot the breeze. I've never been bold enough to fish directly from the dump's central piles of rusted cast-offs. But its swap shop, a tiny cottage, had come to serve as a free boutique of sorts, and there I discovered many items of weird delight, including a pair of sky blue clogs that could pass for Rachel Comey, and a circa 1970 Gucci scarf patterned with leaping zebras that earned me compliments at Paris Fashion Week. I love the swap shop, and not only because everything was free. When I walked into curated antiseptic boutiques, I felt starved for novelty. Surveying the swap shop's jumble, I saw infinite possibilities. Even the most dated clothes seemed ready to spring to life, like actors of a certain age waiting to be rediscovered by Quentin Tarantino. As years went by and the 1% inched closer to making up to 100% of the town's population, the summer people began to drop off some jarringly pristine items. I've dug out perfectly wearable APC sweaters and COS shirts, and a family friend told me about finding a Ferragamo bag with leftover cash inside it. My father found a fine sweatshirt from a posh private school. "Did you go to Brooklyn, friends?" people would ask when he wore it. "No," he would answer. "I went to the swap shop." When I began thrifting and scrounging my way to some semblance of personal style, there was still something shameful about admitting that your clothes had a past, unknowable to you, unknowable to you life. I've spent a decade and a half covering fashion. I'm Elle's fashion features director now. And over that time, I've seen the industry awakening to sustainability and reuse. Luxury brands that once destroyed and even burned unsold merchandise are now thinking of ways to reinvent it. Salvage and resale have become antidotes to the conveyor belt of fast fashion, wherein clothing behemoths like Shein offer thousands of new styles every week. Social media users display their latest avalanche of purchases in haul videos, and Instagram influencers post themselves in new outfits multiple times a day. When some have so little and others are drowning in a surfeit of options, the flaunting of abundance, so long the central driver of our screen-based existence, starts to feel like bad manners. Making new things out of others' cast-offs is something small-town America has done for decades. In a sort of municipal precursor to FreeCycle or Buy Nothing groups, the importance of sharing resources became increasingly clear as the COVID-19 pandemic raged. For more and more people, getting free stuff from neighbors went from being a quirk or a fun excuse for a day's outing to being a necessary form of mutual aid. COVID taught us lessons about mutual aid, but of course it also challenged every community that tried to live by them, and it's not yet clear what any of us are taking away from the last 2 years. During the pandemic, the swap shop closed, leaving the area without its social escape valve. When it reopened last summer, it might as well have been a hot new downtown club. Indeed, my first trip back felt like somewhat of a velvet rope experience. The town had become more vigorously enforcing its $100 access permit. I went with a friend, and to my relief, the place was still a dump, full of water-damaged paperbacks on past life regression, back issues of defunct magazines, baby shoes often worn. We helped a family lug several boxes marked garage into the swap shop, and our reward was taking the first run at their contents. I walked away with a bracelet, a necklace that must have belonged to a kooky aunt. The braces had split in two, but I figured that with a little super glue, it could be restored to its mid-century splendor. The social slippage that has led the world to become a macrocosm of the swap shop. So many of us free diving for usable ephemera, pooling our limited resources with one another, is not something to celebrate. The division between the haves and the have-nots seems more sharply drawn every day, and the fact that the former can bestow a designer item on the latter when they tire of it is hardly a balm, especially when even that slight gesture is available only to those have-nots who have enough to pay the price of admission. But still, there are small joys to be snatched in those moments of coming together, a version of something better amid the refuse. Veronique Hyland is the fashion features director of Elle. Her debut essay collection is Dress Code, Unlocking Fashion from the New Look to Millennial Pink, HarperCollins, 2022. Thank you for joining us for the New York Times Magazine. My name is Bill McCann.